listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past weekend, peace activists from around the world converged on Dublin, Ireland, for the global campaign against U.S. NATO military bases. Black Agenda Report columnist Margaret Kimberly was one of those in attendance, and we spoke with her via Skype Tuesday. Margaret, welcome back to the United States.
Thank you very much.
So we're talking about the International Conference Against U.S. NATO Military Bases, which was held in Dublin, Ireland.
Yes. And this is the second conference. This is the first international conference. We met first in Baltimore earlier this year in January 2018. The group, this coalition of groups dedicated to ending this spread of U.S. 800 bases and other facilities around the world. So we met in Baltimore to plan and to talk about and to learn about the extent of the U.S. presence in so many different countries. And so there was a decision made to have an international conference, which would allow some people to attend who may find it difficult, if not impossible, to enter the United States. And one of the coalition members is an Irish group called PANA, Peace and Neutrality Alliance. Ireland is officially neutral. It's not a member of NATO. And yet they gave permission right after 9/11 for the U.S. military to use a base in Shannon, Ireland, which is a political issue there. So PANA were the hosts. There were about 300 people from 35 different nations. And I chaired the panel discussing AFRICOM.
Yeah. I caught the live stream. First of all, hats off to whoever ran the live stream. I got to capture things off of the internet from time to time for radio, and the audio quality of a lot of things. You know, I mean, you know, we're always working on a shoestring. It is always a little difficult and too often not airworthy for commercial quote unquote radio. But both the video and audio on that stream were fantastic. They were truly broadcast quality, and you know, they were almost invisible, so that you felt like you were in attendance and could hear what was being said, which is the point of it. So whoever did that, get them back for the next one. They did a really good job.
Sure will. We'll do that.
So were the speakers too, though. I saw the panel on AFRICOM, and I'd like to get you know, some of your thoughts and observations about that.
Yes, we I chaired the meeting on AFRICOM. The AFRICOM is the U.S. Africa Command, and one of the hats I wear is as a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. And Black Alliance for Peace has committed itself to demanding an end to AFRICOM. This is it started in October 1st, 2008, during the tail end of the Bush administration. And I don't know how many people know that the United States has divvied up the world into various commands. There's a NORTHCOM and a SOUTHCOM and a CENTCOM, and they started an AFRICOM, although it is headquartered in Stuttgart, Germany.
Right.
And at the time, there were only a couple of U.S. military facilities on the continent. Now there are more than 80. Most African nations have joined AFRICOM, which means that their militaries are controlled by the United States.
Right.
And this is very dangerous for the continent. It not only is it's always bad. Someone asked me over the weekend, is there anything good about U.S. Military interventions or any military activities? And I said no. And this person asked me, well, is it possible they could help, or they could bring doctors, or they could? And my response was, if countries all over the world were allowed to develop without interference, they wouldn't need doctors from other countries. Our goal should be to work for self-determination of all nations, instead of having a system where the United States decides who can and can't run a country and overthrow someone if they don't like them. And if they're socialists, they destroy the country and then point fingers and say, oh, see, socialism doesn't work. So there is nothing, all that to say, there's nothing good about this presence. It's always, of course, couched in humanitarian terms, peace and development. But just to use Somalia as an example, Somalia ended a disastrous war with Ethiopia only for the United States to involve itself, to actually send troops at one point, to make sure that this country was not allowed to free itself and be independent. So when you send, when AFRICOM, when Kenya, for example, joins AFRICOM, and it's couched in the terms of fighting the war on terror, fighting al-Shabaab in Somalia, there wouldn't be an al-Shabaab if the United States would leave Somalia alone.
Right.
So at any rate, that is an example of the problems that the U.S. presence creates. I was joined on the panel by Paul Prumfrey, the founder of Friends of Congo, also a coordinating committee member of Black Alliance for Peace, Anna Tumbo from Kenya, president of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Kenya, and Chris Matlako from the South African Peace Initiative. And we did a very good job, if I may say so, with talking about various permutations of AFRICOM and the impact of the U.S. role, and pointing out that it's a part of a continuing scramble for Africa, which started in the 1880s with the Berlin Conference, when European nations divided up the continent, and independence, technical independence, but the former colonizers, especially France, made sure that their colonies were dependent on the colonizing nations. So this is actually not a new story. So our goal with the Black Alliance for Peace is to demand, especially now that the Democrats are in control of Congress. Let's see what this really means after all. We have a petition. You can find it on the Black Alliance for Peace website. You can also go to change.org and search for AFRICOM and find our petition, which is now in six languages, I believe six: English, French, Spanish, Arabic, German, Vietnamese. I think that's six. And we are trying to get to 10,000 signatures by January 15th, which is Dr. King's birthday. Right. And our petition demands an end to AFRICOM and demands that the Congressional Black Caucus take up this issue, hold hearings, and lead the effort to end this interference with African nations. Now, you know, people may snicker at the thought of that, but we know that we are in making this demand, we're going to be exposing them as the collaborators that they are. It's been a long time since the Congressional Black Caucus has been the conscience of the Congress, very long time, yeah. As they have succumbed to money in politics, some of their members being targeted for defeat. It's been a long time since they were the most progressive members. They've moved rightward along with the rest of the Democratic Party. But we're going to do this anyway. And it's important for Black Alliance for Peace to be a part of these international efforts to keep Africa in the forefront and AFRICOM in the forefront as a tool of U.S. and NATO in trying to control as much of the world as possible. Recently, Germany started sending troops to Niger. I mean, why is Germany in Niger?
Right.
I mean, we know Niger has uranium. It is uranium, correct? Yellow cake uranium.
Correct.
Am I saying the right mineral?
Yes, you are.
Anyway.
Yep.
Okay. So there's an American presence. AFRICOM was first in the news about a year ago when four American troops were killed there.
Right.
AFRICOM hardly ever made it into the word in the corporate media.
Right.
And politicians didn't talk about it. And some of them, right. Some members of Congress actually claimed they didn't know there was an American presence in Niger. And who knows whether they're being shifty or just are that stupid or just don't care enough.
They vote on the funding for it. So somewhere.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. They know that troops are being sent somewhere.
Yep.
And that's the other reason that Black Alliance for Peace is in existence, this enormous military budget, which Democrats vote. You know, it's a funny thing about Trump. They all talk about Trump. He's a fascist. He's a racist. He's a, you know, I could go on and on with the pejorative terms, and I'm not defending him. But if you think he's a moron and a psycho, why did you give him more military, a bigger military budget than the one he requested? And most members of the Congressional Black Caucus joined in that charade as well. And now, being typical Democrats, they out of one side of their mouth, they'll talk about spending on the human needs of Americans. And on the other hand, they'll vote for a bigger military budget. Well, you can't have both. So you either want a bigger military budget or you want the government to take care of human needs. You cannot have both, which they know. They're just being cynical. So that's another reason why it's important to carry that demand to them.
You know, there's a few things that people should know. We've been covering AFRICOM really since we started doing these newscasts. I remember first hearing of AFRICOM during the presidential campaign in 2008 when I was covering Cynthia McKinney. And she was talking about how it was working its way through Congress and was likely to be approved in, you know, September, October. It ended up being October of 2008. At the time, the U.S. had its headquarters. The headquarters were still in Stuttgart, but that was pretty much the real estate that it owned. I learned from listening to the broadcast on Sunday that AFRICOM did, or the U.S. in any event, did have a couple of bases, three I think they said, on the continent at the time of the inception of AFRICOM. But now if you look at the website, which is AFRICOM.mil, AFRICOM.mil for military, the area of responsibility, there are 52 African nations, is divided into West, South, Central, East, and North Africa, and just about every nation state on the continent is listed there as an area of responsibility of the United States Africa Command, which is what AFRICOM stands for. And you mentioned the relationship between the old colonial powers and the new ones. It's funny with Germany, first of all. They fought two world wars basically to keep Germany out of Africa so that the England and France and the U.S. could own it. And now they get a boat ride in on some U.S. aircraft carrier. Like France, for example, when they started the takedown of resistance to a U.S. occupation of Africa during the Obama administration, Obama, by the way, this is his child, went from zero to 52 nations during the Obama administration, except for the last couple over the last year or two. You had France essentially escort the president of Cote d'Ivoire, an independent country, an independent president, out of the presidential palace at gunpoint and install a guy who used to be the IMF, with the International Monetary Fund, as president right before they got rid of Gaddafi.
Yes, I mean, as I was saying, I touched on it briefly. France is the biggest perpetrator of maintaining their colonial relationships. Their currency, they control the Francophone, their former colonies control their finances.
Right. They still print francs, even though they don't use them in France anymore. They still print the francs for the old colonies.
Yes, they do. They have it's called the CFA, I believe. But at any rate, France is always intervening in African countries. And Macron, he visited, can't recall which country last year, and lectured Africans about not complaining anymore about colonialism and taking responsibility. So yes, it's a multinational effort, and all this talk about having a European army is not a good thing. People being tripped up by Trump yet again because he doesn't have a good relationship with Macron or Merkel. Their call for a European army is not a call for peace. It's a call for more militarism.
Right.
Just loosening the connection with the United States.
Right.
So this is an ongoing problem for the world in general and for Africa in particular to free itself from the domination of European countries and the U.S. And yes, you're right. They did steal Germany's. It's interesting. It's commemorated the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One, and right. Without mentioning that the war was fought for empire, and
right.
Germany's colonies were snatched up in Africa were snatched up by Britain and France. So, but that's another story. The way World War One was remembered, it was a lost opportunity to talk about some important issues, and it was all about poppies, and Jeremy Corbyn was criticized because his poppy was smaller than somebody else's. I mean, it was horrible. But yes, it's 100 years ago, these various powers in Europe joined somewhat late in the game by the United States, blundered their way into a world war. I don't think any of them thought they were going to have a war that killed millions of people that was going to last for 4 years. But that's exactly what happened. And I mentioned that to say that I'm always fearful of unintended consequences. I think these world leaders are not as smart as we often think they are. And they can do things to start something bigger than what they intended.
Yeah. Yeah, in an age of nuclear weapons, that's a pretty scary concept, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So, some of the other panels, some of the other discussions that took place centered on militarism, nuclear weapons, and military bases. You'd mentioned there's more than 800 of those. The environmental and health impacts of those bases, I don't think people are aware of the fact that just the scale of environmental impact of all of that. And then some of the other areas, like Southcom, you mentioned before, and Asia-Pacific, Middle East, of course, which has been one very busy area for the U.S., certainly, and its NATO allies as its couch. Maybe you want to do a little tour of the landscape on that stuff.
Sure. It was, as I said, an international conference, and there were panels devoted to different regions of the world. It's very interesting what's happening in Okinawa. There is the people do not want an expense, a huge American military presence in Okinawa, in Japan, although the Okinawans are their own ethnicity. It's essentially a big landing strip for the United States. There are all kinds of problems, health problems. You know, all of these bases, by the way, they bring with them pollution. The Defense Department, I believe, is the biggest polluter in the world. And all of these climate change agreements exempt the military. I don't know if people Right. were aware of that. And also, you know, Okinawans want to be sovereign. They want to be sovereign from Japan. But the United States has been permitted to continue to expand its military presence there, and people there do not want it. And the people who have advocated and taken action against it have been the targets of the Japanese state. So there was a panel, an Asia-Pacific panel, and which discussed the situation in Okinawa. Australians. There were Australians there talking about the huge military presence there. There's a surveillance facility in a place called Pine Gap, and the NSA uses it to spy on the entire world. Mm. There's also a huge fleet in the Pacific, and anything you know that happens in Asia, we have to assume it's being directed against China. Sure. The Korea issue, it is a good thing that the two Koreas are talking about some form of reunification in some way. It's a good thing that the U.S. is talking to the DPRK, to North Korea. There are concerns about the ever expanding number of NATO nations. After the fall of the Soviet Union, NATO expanded right up to Russia's borders, which is incredibly dangerous. And a lot of these countries didn't really even want to join NATO. They wanted to join the EU. But it's almost a requirement of EU membership to become a NATO member as well. So Hungary and Poland and the Czech Republic, and there were people from some of these nations who are opposed to the expanding American presence in their countries. There are a huge number of American facilities in Italy, in Greece. There are panelists from the Caribbean and Latin America. One of our keynote speakers was Dr. Aleida Guevara, Che Guevara's daughter. She's a physician, a member of the Cuban Assembly, talking about Guantanamo. We still have this base on the island of Cuba. The threats against Venezuela, the threats against Nicaragua. Colombia, they're making Colombia, the South American nation, a member of NATO. And that can be used. Venezuela is right next door. Right. So Colombia is a key part of the U.S. Attack on that country. So all of these regions, also the continuing expansion of NATO in Europe, these tiny countries, Montenegro and Macedonia, and they're changing the name of Macedonia because Greece doesn't want it to be called Macedonia, but right. I don't know why it needs to be in NATO anyway. And then, of course, we're told that Putin is evil and wants to expand everywhere. And it looks to me like it's the Western nations that want to expand everywhere. Right, right. Russia has a military presence in, I think, 7 or 8 countries, you know, as opposed to the 100 countries that have a U.S. and NATO military presence. So we spoke of all these things. We spoke about the environmental damage done by these military facilities. enduring environmental damage, chemicals that leach into the soil. And even if a military base leaves, the environment in this particular location can be endangered for decades to come. And we talked about how to mobilize. And that's for me, that is the key. How do we mobilize? That's why I'm happy about the Black Alliance for Peace effort. This is a beginning of our making a political demand, putting people on notice about the Democratic Party and how it works. We're told that it was so important for the Democrats to win the majority in the House, and so we're going to find out if they support their people. It isn't clear to me that most Americans are aware of AFRICOM's existence or its extent. You know, when those soldiers were killed, the big story was Trump insulting the widow, and he insulted the congresswoman, right. And what did they say? And it was an opportunity to talk about AFRICOM,
right.
And to talk about the U.S. military presence on the continent. So we want to bring it back there. And all these members of the Congressional Black Caucus who got involved in this food fight with Trump, now they can talk about AFRICOM. We're going to ask them to do that.
Good.
And it's a way for us to also to mobilize people, to bring awareness, and also to activate our population so that people can stop. That's what I always want anyway, to stop this dependence on the Democratic Party and this belief that the only thing saving us from barbarism is this party that does nothing or acts against our interests.
Now, just looking at the the condition of the left, forces inside the United States in opposition to imperialism, to the empire. We have a lot of work to do, and you're poised to do a lot. Your involvement with this transnational grouping and organizing it further is really important. Also with the Black Alliance for Peace, and you have a lot of heads because you got all those hats. the United National Anti-War Coalition. The demands that are being raised all across the United States for things that are needed, it doesn't even matter which political figure people line up behind, whether it's jobs or assistance with housing or education expense or healthcare or whatever. There are desperate needs, and they're not being met, and they can't be met unless the money is diverted from the military, bottom line.
Exactly.
And so making that connection is very difficult because the media is, not just complicit, but an active participant in the militarization of the society and the maintenance of that condition. But the material demands of the people are there, and they don't go away without being satisfied. Is there some kind of a strategy that we can be working on developing further or helping in one way or another that's maybe underway? To sort of move this process along so we're not dead before we finally get to a point where it can happen?
I think it's important for those of us on the left, and that, in this country, with the two political parties moving ever further to the right, any neoliberal Democrat gets to call themselves on the left. But those of us who are really on the left, who are in favor of true democracy, who want to see huge cuts in the military budget, who want to see the government resume its role, its proper role with its people, and regulate corporations to do away with corporate personhood and billionaire rule. Those are the things I believe that make, among others, put one on the left. It's important for us to maintain our stance. It's important for us to differentiate ourselves. It's important for us not to allow people to be phony and call themselves progressives when they're not, and to keep making the case for these issues that I mentioned, and to not be afraid to denounce the Democratic Party. The Democrats are the problem. And our goal as leftists should not be, should not be to create a third party. Our system is very hostile to third parties and relegates them to spoiler status. But we need to be the second party. We need to build a true people's party, a true workers' party, a true peace party, and put the Democrats out of business. And we cannot be afraid. We cannot be intimidated by allowing the people who put Trump in office to blame us for putting Trump in office to silence us. So I think we just have to plant our flag.
Yeah, and by the way, had we not put Trump in office, had we put Hillary Clinton in office, you would still have to have had this conference because, if anything, we'd have more war going on than we do now.
Yeah, she is. It's so hard to talk. It's funny because everything, it's hypothetical because she didn't become right. president. So all we have to rely on is her word.
Her word. But, that's dicey but for American politicians, though. That is dicey.
yeah. For well, what she said. And at any rate, she said she wanted to establish a no-fly zone in Syria, which would have escalated the situation there. She was very much anti-Russian. She never passed up an opportunity to talk about the need to confront Putin and so on. I mean, it was kind of crazy. Yeah. But yes, we still would have to do this. You know, the Democrats have not. I mean, when have they been the party of peace? So she would have, if we believe what the thing she said she was going to do, she would have continued the anti-Russia policy. She is a cold warrior. She is a neoliberal. She is a neocon. So yes, if you have a Democratic president, you still have to have an international effort of solidarity against imperialism and U.S. and NATO interventions. That's something that will not change if you have a Democrat in the White House. And you know, when that day comes that there is a Democrat back in the White House, people should not fold up their tents and breathe a sigh of relief that it's not the awful Republicans, and realize, especially when it comes to foreign policy, that there's no difference between the two parties.
Yeah, last time we did that, we got AFRICOM. Margaret, thank you very much.
Yes, we did.
Margaret,
among
Kimberly,
other things.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. What is the next step for the saga known as Brexit? Also, is a stage being set to finally end the Syrian conflict? And why is MI6 scrambling to stop Trump? Crosstalking some real news. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Arthur Demchuk. He is deputy dean at the Department of Political Science at Moscow State University. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Arthur, let me go to you first here. Well, it's done, at least this stage of Brexit. The European Union has accepted Theresa May's deal. The problem is it doesn't look like the deal has been accepted in her own country. It has to face Parliament, and there's a lot of squabbling, to say the least, that it won't get through. But what is the context of all of this here? Because, you know, I was trained as a historian. We had the concept of the concert of Europe. We had balance of power in Europe. Is that balance gone now?
Well, I think that this balance is not always the same. It changes over time, and I can remind of the times of Charles de Gaulle when he tried to prevent British accession to the EU. So only when he was no longer president, Britain joined the European Union.
European Economic Community.
Yes. And then the
European Union. That's my favorite one, not the EU.
So maybe now the history repeats at the next step of history. We got going back to the time when Britain was out of the European Community. But if we talk about nowadays developments, I can say that the British Prime Minister is trying to play a double game because there are too many stakeholders, too many interests, and I was sure there will be a deal, and then there is a deal
But we've talked about this before. No deal is better than a compromise, or a compromise is better than no deal.
Yes, no deal was not an option, because any compromise is better than no deal, because everyone will be worse off if there is no compromise.
Okay, Mark is dissenting. I know that look.
I'm afraid, Arthur, I completely disagree.
Why?
And a deal that makes Britain subservient to EU regulations and control without giving them any representation politically makes them a second-class colony. It's the worst of both worlds. Voters voted for Brexit. They get the EU control and lack of sovereignty that they wanted away from, and they don't get the economic benefits as strongly as they still might have liked. So I see it as the absolute worst of both worlds.
Well, maybe Parliament is going to agree with you. Dima, jump in.
Well, I think the viewers of our program know my attitude to the EU, so I feel kind of vindicated. I feel confirmed in my worst suspicions. Because actually, what happened was that the EU made it a sample, you know. They wanted to make it as difficult for Britain to leave the EU.
Why wouldn't they?
We were told that this was a free union of nations based on completely different foundations than the previous ones. And now we see that this is a kolkhoz, which is basically worse than kolkhoz.
I don't think everybody understands that. I think it's the Hotel California, you know. You can never leave here, okay? Yes. Last word on this?
At the same time, they followed very smart way of doing that. They said, let's agree on principles and let's discuss details later. So the devil may be in the details, and British may negotiate and haggle about the details that are favorable
to them. Yeah, but at the end of the day, Theresa May can sign any piece of paper she wants, Parliament is going to follow through on that. So it isn't over yet.
Details that cost $48 billion. These are nice details, right?
60 billion euros.
I'm still wondering if this terrible deal rejected scenario is not intended to lead to
Mark will probably be talking about this next week. Okay, let's switch gears here. Mark, there is movement. Well, you wouldn't find this out in the mainstream media. What's going on with Aleppo? What's going on with moving towards peace?
Well, we're not moving towards peace in Syria. We've just moved to a new and far more dangerous stage in the conflict. And right now, we essentially have a frozen conflict, a three-way Mexican standoff between Syria with their allies, the Russian government, Iran, and Hezbollah, the Erdogan's regime and Turkey backing the Islamists and jihadists, both officially their proxy forces and unofficially, particularly in Idlib province where there's a demilitarized zone, and the U.S. backing the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is largely the Kurds, the PKK, in eastern Syria, basically occupying eastern Syria and, of course, Syria's oil fields. And this DMZ agreement between Russia and Turkey, essentially, with the Syrian government and the jihadi rebels not actually being a party to the talks, as far as anyone can tell, as we predicted on the show, it's completely falling apart for the same reason that every other deal has fallen apart, is that most of the rebels are Al-Qaeda and they're not adhering to the terms of the agreement.
There's ample evidence that the Damascus government is preparing some kind of operation to begin the liberation of Aleppo?
Well, just
Idlib, excuse me.
Just in the end of last week, Aleppo was bombed by artillery shells with chlorine. You know, basically chemical weapons were used, most likely by Jabhat al-Nusra. It did not make big news in the Western television, but it certainly made big news in Syria.
Yeah, so they're not reporting that the rebels are attacking the Syrian
there's
people.
The reason. There's the reason.
And the shells came from the Idlib area, from this supposedly peaceful demilitarized zone that the United States and the EU were so concerned about. But what made me especially angry was the fact that the United States imposed sanctions on the oil companies that supplied fuel to Syria. Can you imagine, you know, post-war Europe, 1946, 1947, someone would say, oh, because we're not quite happy with the political situation in Europe, any company that supplies fuel to the devastated Germany or to other countries will be penalized. And this is exactly what Michael Pompeo said, you know, imposing the sanctions on the Syrian and Iranian and Russian companies. He said, today, U.S. Treasury action targeting the Russia-Iran oil scheme to prop up Assad and finance Hezbollah and Hamas sends a clear message. There are grave consequences for anyone shipping oil to Syria.
Hamas?
Well, he puts them together because for him it doesn't matter.
Vegetarian state!
Sunnis, Shia, it doesn't matter.
Nikki Haley will never leave us.
Pompeo is just... In order to justify the fact that the U.S. is now sanctioning trade, oil trade, there's no reason for the U.S. to sanction. There is a reason, of course. It's occupying Syria's oil fields, and it doesn't want the Syrian government getting oil to stay alive and rebuild their country. So they're not allowed to import it. You are no longer allowed to conduct free trade, global trade, if it doesn't meet U.S. approval. Because if you conduct trade that doesn't meet U.S. approval, you will now be sanctioned. That's what Pompeo is saying.
These entities and these companies are going to continue to do it, irrespective of the sanctions. This is why I always say, if you want to go down the sanction rabbit hole, your likelihood of success is quite limited.
Yeah, well, if we think about Syrian conflict in a large scale context, I would say that even if now this situation is frozen, there are several issues still. First, that you mentioned that there was only agreement between Russia and Turkey, maybe with considering a Syria's approach, but there were no other parties who are concerned about the conflict. They were not involved into making this decision, so they may prevent this decision from being implemented. So the situation is very unstable, and even if this conflict is frozen, it only gives time to both sides to accumulate their potential to continue
that,
conflict.
I'm much more for the engagement and the diplomacy. We still had in Istanbul, we had Macron, we had Merkel go there, meet with Erdogan, with President Putin. These initiatives are difficult, but they have traction, and I believe it. Okay, it has to happen.
And there actually has been, I would say, even more traction with the Arab governments, with the UAE talking about reestablishing an embassy in Syria, and this shows that the Gulf states have basically given up the proxy war, and they're coming to terms with a Damascus.
I suppose the Saudis have other things to think
about Yemen. Well, but when we say frozen conflict, I said frozen conflict. Right. It's, of course, that's only rhetorical. Yeah. It's not actually frozen.
Yes, it's not
the rebel jihadis, al-Qaeda, in Idlib are weekly conducting attacks to the west into Latakia, to the south into Hama, and to the east into West Aleppo, with Dima mentioned, with these chlorine artillery shells. So it's only frozen by political agreement not to go direct Russian-Turkish war.
Russia crossed a very important threshold last week, because the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, directly accused the United States of acting as an ally of the so-called Islamic State, at least on the territory of Syria. And from him, I think it was very painful for him, because for years, that we would have cooperation with the United States fighting terrorists. Now, after all of these
years. Well, that's what Lavrov's supposed to do, Mark. Yes. Okay, you can lament it all you want, but that's what he's supposed to do.
I think it's a positive development, because if you look at the situation, Mark is right. UAE is talking about reopening the embassy. Turkey and Iran, perennial enemies, are cooperating on doing something in Syria, you know, for settlement. Who is absolutely insisting on regime change? The EU and the United States, supposedly the most civilized Western nations. You know?
After everything that we've gone through here, Mark, last word before we go to the break?
Yeah, I mean, we're just entering a new stage of the conflict, and be prepared that if there is a military operation, Idlib is extremely fortified territory with the Turkish military heavily entrenched there, along with their jihadis, and it will be more difficult than tackling ISIS was. This is why they're such reticent, and okay. It may lead to direct Turkish-Russian war.
Okay, and we'll return to this topic very soon here. We're going to go to a short break, gentlemen, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go to you, Mark. Let's just speak real quickly because this story is ongoing. MI6 is trying to stop Trump from releasing the FISA warrants and documentation because, well, they're implicated in it. So we have UK meddling in the American election 2016. I suppose the reason why Trump decided not to release them in September, like he said he would, is that he's waiting for the Mueller report. Mueller's going to have his findings. Trump is going to have a Trump card to counter whatever findings that Mueller has. And the British are furious about it.
Yeah, I mean, there is a danger of the UK being far more factually implicated in meddling in the US elections, like should have been obvious to anyone. And their connections with the Steele dossier and this being the basis for launching what would then become the Mueller probe, basically discrediting all of it. So Trump is playing for the best possible time, I believe, to release these. And it will be effectively a refutation. Not that we have any evidence that Mueller has released any indictments or anything that would actually prove what the investigation was supposed to be about, which was Trump-Russia collusion. And we've got Manafort for back taxes. We've got a couple guys lying about things that weren't crimes. There's nothing serious in there. But, you know, there's still this holy grail mission that the Mueller report is supposed to discredit the Trump administration and lead to a Democratic Party victory in 2020, if not impeachment beforehand. And with the Democrats, again and again, I keep seeing Hillary Clinton's name popping up as the only possible one who can beat Trump in 2020. And I'm like, this is the common definition of madness, doing things again and again and expecting a different
outcome. Yeah. Dima, so Trump has some very powerful cards to play if he wants.
Well, it's very simple, you know. The whole story is just made up, you know.
Well, you heard it first on this program, okay.
How long can it continue? I mean, the point is that, unfortunately, MI6 is the last institution that is not biased in all of this situation. I mean, we have heard from the...
Explain that, Dima.
Okay. If we heard from the head of the British General Staff, Mark Carlton Smith, you know... That's not MI6, but that's the guy who is supposed to be working together with MI6.
The head of the British military.
Intelligence. So here's what he says. Russia is much more dangerous than the Islamic State. Russia has embarked on a systematic effort to explore and exploit Western vulnerabilities, particularly in some of the non-traditional areas of cyber, space, undersea warfare, end of quote. Well, you remember their idea that Russia was somehow going to cut the cables connecting Europe to the United States, and this is serious, you know, it was stated as a fact by the Defense Secretary of the UK. This was said
in the 1980s when they had the gas pipelines to Europe.
If you believe this, then you're going to believe Russiagate, you can believe anything. I think Howard Kunstler put it very well on Zero Hedge. He wrote, "It's not too late for some institutions like the New York Times and CNN to change out their editors and producers and go back to reporting the reality instead of functioning as agitprop mills for every unsound idea gene through the Yale Humanities Departments." End of quote. Well, the problem is that they won't stop acting as
these
aliens.
Well, the interesting thing is that, you know, we hear from the British defense establishment that Russia is a real threat, but MI6 is doing everything it can to effect regime change in the United States. So is that what you do to friends? No.
Trump is not a friend.
All right, we got to switch gears here. Dima, G20 is coming up, and the reason why I'm mentioning G20 is that there's going to be, well, some interesting red faces, I would imagine, with some of the guests. I think you know where I'm going with this.
Well, I think the murder of Khashoggi has already changed the Middle East, because quietly, the siege of Qatar is lifted. So this man did not die for nothing. Quietly, Trump is saying that it was the mad and cruel world that killed Khashoggi, not the royal family, you know, as the U.S. intelligence
cruel
reported.
World, really?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can justify anything.
Well, we could make a separate program on who makes the world cruel.
Exactly, okay. That's a good question.
You know, but, I mean, this is going to be, it's very interesting here, is that the fact is the Trump administration wants to rehabilitate the Saudi crown prince, and it's coming up against a lot of resistance.
Yeah, I mean, Trump is basically ignoring this broadside.
This didn't happen.
Who cares? Right? That's essentially what he's saying. He's saying who effing cares, right? About Khashoggi's death. And I mean, there is a point. I mean, it's obvious that Khashoggi wasn't some innocent journalist.
No, he was a player.
He was a protege of the former intelligence chief of a former presumed crown prince, and he was evidently involved in all kinds of initiatives with the CIA to lay the groundwork against Mohammed bin Salman. So, I mean, with NGOs and initiatives that he was setting up. So, and he was a player, right? Of course, that doesn't excuse what he did. And Trump is obviously following along with his, campaign rhetoric, which was Saudi Arabia and Israel first. Or something like that. What you're talking about at the G20 is of course, Mohammed bin Salman is going to be around, trying to go around and smiling and shaking hands and pretending like nothing happened. I think he ought to just, play, own what he did. I think he ought to sit down at the table in the G20 and just lay a bone saw down on the table and say,
Mark.
No, but the point is that Trump said, we're standing with Saudi Arabia. Obviously, he was standing there at the table when they were doing these things to Khashoggi. He was not just standing by. He is saying that he is standing with, like Obama said, we are standing with the government of Ukraine when they started bombing.
The interesting thing here is that I guess the oddity of Trump's characterizations of this murder and of the regime in Riyadh is that he's basically saying his words reflect reality, because foreign policy is not based on values. It's based on interests. Okay,
yes, sure.
I mean, he said it in a very awkward way, but he's probably the first president that's ever said it. And that's really kind of interesting in itself.
It's refreshing in a way.
Well, in a weird way. Yeah, Mark, keep that chainsaw away from me, okay?
President Trump is still a businessman. He's very pragmatic, so he's...
Well, so what's the term they use now? Transactional. Everything's transactional.
Yes, so business first. In this case, he tries to create as much uncertainty as possible, saying maybe yes, maybe no. We don't know exactly who is guilty and who is not, why this decision was made, and so on. So,
but that's really odd rhetoric from a guy that always knows what's right and what's wrong.
Yes,
I mean, this is the only topic I think he's ever come across he waffles so much.
But he wants to keep any option open for him. For his further steps.
Mark, is Khashoggi,
not,
Khashoggi
not,
affair
not
something that's going to pull Trump's foreign policy initiatives in the Middle East down? I mean, the great bargain with the Israelis, the Saudis. I mean, it's only two people now. It's Bibi Netanyahu and Trump that are big supporters of the crown prince.
And Netanyahu, I think, is certainly doing a lot to prevent. Behind closed doors to prevent and discourage the U.S. from doing anything. And let's be perfectly honest. Trump's tone and rhetoric are, one thing. But no other U.S. president is going to substantially decrease U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia because of this. They simply might have preferred to see a different evil crown prince, in Saudi Arabia. But all is not lovey-dovey here, because with these, Saudi Arabia was clearly counting on these oil sanctions against Iran and other countries. And remember, the backdrop of all of this that Israel and Saudi Arabia want is the U.S. to go to conflict with Iran,
right?
And these oil waivers that Trump granted its allies, Japan, Turkey, Iraq,
except
South
for the
Korea,
Europeans.
Italy, right? Well, Italy got one,
okay,
right? But, you know, India and China, countries that obviously weren't going to follow it anyway, has dropped the oil price because the markets were expecting these sanctions and the oil price went up and now it dropped another like $20 a barrel. Saudis are very unhappy about this because their budget is still very precariously balanced,
right,
and overspent. So they think that the Trump administration has betrayed them by granting waivers to its allies when it was counting on a high oil price to carry it through.
Well, there may be waivers to some of the allies, but Michael Pence, the vice president, used some very tough rhetoric against China right before
so that'll be another G20. Interesting meeting.
Exactly. That's even
the
costlier than the story with the oil prices. Pence actually said that we slapped tariffs on the Chinese goods worth of $250 billion, and we want China to change its behavior. Well, that's a nice way to put it. You know, Russia and China, they have to behave like normal nations. This is what we hear from the United States,
like the
from
United
the
States
EU.
Invading and occupying
yes,
countries?
Exactly. That's a good question that I think one of the authors on RT Opinion asked. What does it mean exactly behaving like a normal state? Attacking Iraq, you know,
what
attacking Libya.
Sanctions.
But see, the American political elite don't see, they can't see the irony in it at all. Because of this kind of moral righteousness, okay? Again, going back to Trump's kind of weird, transparent reflections and descriptions of U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia. I mean, he doesn't use this, we're doing it for human rights, we're doing it for democracy. At least he's not said that, okay? But someone of Pence's stripe certainly does believe that, because
yes.
Only the American way is the only way,
but
and is the only right way.
The point is that unfortunately, Russia and China can only survive together in this situation because we are both targeted by the United States, and all the attempts to cut a deal to somehow separate yourself from the
mess has left the station.
It's impossible. So I think this G20 meeting will show what the real juxtaposition of forces is. If China tries to survive alone, it won't.
Well, the interesting thing is that Trump believes that the U.S. should lead.
Yeah.
But we'll end on this note. Yeah. Fewer and fewer people are following. Okay, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.